Hello and welcome into the Cowboys. I'm Tyler Bischoff, along with me, Mike Gramala over from RunRev.com. Today we're talking a little bit about UNLV Air Force, a lot about Rashad Vaughn, Chris Wood, and some Jerry Tarkanian as well. Might even mention a little bit Boise State, since that's who UNLV has coming up on Wednesday. But Mike, we'll start with that Air Force game. And, you know, first game without Rashad Vaughn, but what I took from it was they didn't lose that game because of offense. They lost that game because they couldn't get stops against Air Force in the second half.
Yeah, they scored pretty efficiently. I think everyone was most concerned about how they'd be able to score. Would they be able to put up points because Vaughn was such a big part of their offense. High usage, pretty much everything they did centered around him. But they scored pretty well, could not get stops, especially in the second half. Way too many open shots.
Yeah, I think UNLV scored, it was 1.14 points per possession, which is better than their average in conference play, and it's better than what Air Force normally allows in conference play. But UNLV allowed 1.15 points per possession, which is worse than what they typically allow in conference play, and that's better than what Air Force usually scores in conference play. So, I mean, my question watching it was, looking at kind of Air Force's three-point shooting, they were 9 of 13 in the second half. Coker was 6 of 12 from 3 in the game. But Dave Rice stayed in his zone. They did that in the first meeting. Didn't really hurt him that badly. I mean, I thought in the second half, like, they should go man-to-man. Like, Air Force is not athletically talented enough that they should be forcing UNLV into a zone. I thought they could have played man-to-man and been just fine defensively, a lot better than that.
I think Air Force kind of spooks them. I think 2 years ago, they played man-to-man against Air Force, and Air Force just picked them apart with backdoor cuts and ball screens and motion, and they killed the Rebels man-to-man defense. I think that kind of spooked Dave Rice. It was actually, they came into Thomas and Mack Center, and UNLV really couldn't stop them in man. Later in the year, they played at Air Force, and Rice played, that's when he went to zone for the first time. They played zone pretty much the whole game. I think it's for this game at least, I think it was more of a matchup thing. I don't think they like playing man-to-man against the offense that Air Force runs. So for this game anyways, I would say that would be more of a matchup thing than a philosophical thing.
Well, so because these are the only two times I've seen Air Force play, and I'm trying to. Do you know how much Olshinsky plays on the perimeter rather than inside against man-to-man defenses?
I couldn't tell you without looking it up. I think he's a pick and pop guy. I think probably more of a face-up shooter guy than a guy that's going to post up, you know, Okonobo or Wood down low.
Yeah, because, you know, the zone defense makes sense if you're trying to keep away the backdoor cuts and that stuff, just because it gives you Chris Wood or Okonobo is going to be around the rim. You're not going to give up anything near the basket. So I was trying to figure out a way in my head you could still do that man-to-man-wise if Olshinsky was out on the perimeter, but you really couldn't. So, I don't know. I think I would have liked to have at least seen him go man for a couple possessions and at least chase guys off the three-point line a little bit better. Or even just – because did they play anything besides 2-3 in the second half?
Not that I saw.
Yeah, as far as I remember, they only played 2-3, so maybe just throw a 1-3-1 at him or 1-2-2 that they haven't really run recently. Just to, I don't know, change it up some, because
just to make Air Force think about it. It seemed like once they got into a rhythm, they pretty much knew where to find the holes and how to get openings. At some point, I wouldn't have minded if the Rebels had switched it up. I mean, at that point, you really don't have much to lose the way that they were, you know, getting open shots.
UNLV is a team, even though you lose Rashad Vaughn, should still be able to win at Air Force, right?
Yeah.
Like, they went into the game as a 1 point or 1.5 point underdog, UNLV did. So, obviously, the way UNLV has played this season indicated, okay, without Rashad Vaughn, it's a toss-up game, essentially. But, I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of Dave Rice, and it's, you know, I think it is a little bit warranted that losing one guy shouldn't cause you to lose at Air Force.
I don't know what it is. Like even looking at the numbers leading up to the game, you can see that they weren't all season. They haven't been very good without Rashad Vaughn on the court. But for some reason, I still expected them to win that game. I still thought that they could have gone up there and won. They thought they played offense well enough to win. I'm having trouble marrying those two thoughts where, you know, they should be worse without Vaughn, but I still expected them to win that game.
Not getting stops defensively, it was, you know, Pat McCaw had his four straight possessions where he hit 4 3. So that's 12 points for UNLV in four possessions. That's incredible. The problem was the three Air Force possessions sandwiched in between those, they still got 5 points. So, you know, you allow a team to score 5 points on three possessions while you should be on a really big run. You know, it turned into, okay, UNLV's plus 7 off of that, which is still good. But when Pat McCaw hit his 4 3 in a row, they were still losing by a point. So they were able to get stuff going offensively. Chris Wood was really good again, and we'll talk more about him. But they couldn't do anything defensively, mainly because of what Air Force was able to get on the perimeter. And I don't know. It's a weird thing. I'm going to give you three stat lines, and I want to ask you how important they are, or how much you think they're important, or what you think of them. The first one, Dantley Walker, 1 of 5 shooting, 0 of 4 on threes, and he airballed one. Is that important, indicative of anything going forward?
I would say it's not indicative going forward. It's for Dantley Walker, his role on the team is stand out and shoot three-pointers. That's what they ask him to do. When you bring a guy off the bench and ask him to do that, he's not going to be hot every time. I mean, he's made a great percentage this year, but he wasn't on yesterday. I don't think that's indicative of much. They definitely could have used him knocking down a couple, but it wasn't there last night. I wouldn't say that's too important.
Do you think he loses any playing time over it?
Probably. I think that he's on a very short leash. He didn't play as much as I thought he would against the Air Force. I know he played a long stint in the first half. It seemed like he got a short leash in the second half. He came out, and I think he missed a shot, and he was gone pretty quickly after that. I would expect his playing time to, more than anyone else, to hinge directly on his performance in the previous game or in the previous possession even. If he's making shots, he'll play. If he's not making shots, they really probably don't have a use for him.
Okay, second one, Jordan Cornish played 25 minutes. UNLV was plus 10 in his 25 minutes. Cornish had 6 points, 6 rebounds, and 4 assists. Is that important or indicative of anything?
I would say that it is. So that's what we've seen all year long, is that Cornish is the team leader in plus-minus for the whole season, in limited minutes, obviously. So there's a lot of noise there in terms of the guys that he's playing with when he's on the court. So that's kind of a raw numbers, but the team has been playing well when he's out there for most of the season. And they did again yesterday. So, I mean, that's just continuing a trend that has already been established.
I was really surprised to see him grab 6 rebounds. If you look at his per-game numbers, he had 8 rebounds against St. Catherine. So that one doesn't really count. Other than that, his previous high in rebounds was 2. And he did that a couple times, but the last time was San Jose State. Like, he's played decent minutes recently. He doesn't get rebounds, but he got 6 against Air Force, and then he had 4 assists, which he had 6 assists against St. Catherine, so take away that one. That's his high in assists. He only had 2 in another game. So that's the most he's, like, filled up the stat sheet in terms of things besides points and shooting.
I would argue that I would posit that the lack of rebounding is probably the reason why he hasn't played more minutes this year, despite, you know, being effective in other areas. I think Rice came into the season. He said all along that he wanted Cornish to be one of the guys that he could throw in as a small ball power forward, play the 4 position. But I don't think Cornish has rebounded well enough to play extended minutes there. So I think that's one of the reasons why Cornish hasn't played a lot, despite some of the things that he does bring to the table, like shooting and getting to the free throw line and things like that. It was kind of surprising to see him throw his nose in there and get those rebounds. So I would say that is important and indicative.
He was the guy that Dave Rice talked a lot about before this game, is who's going to get more minutes, who's going to get more opportunities with Vaughn out. So I think it is a big deal. But just looking at some of his games, he played 27 minutes against Boise State, didn't have a rebound, didn't have an assist, didn't have a block. He had three turnovers and a steal. He played 19 against New Mexico, had one rebound and one turnover. Those are the, besides points, those are the only things he registered. And then he played 18 against Utah State, had no rebounds, one assist. Like, he hasn't done anything this season besides score. And so, you know, like, I'd be willing to bet, I'd have to add it up here real quick, his six rebounds is probably more than the amount of rebounds he had in all other conference games this year. It probably is. So I think it's a big deal to see him doing other things, especially the rebounding, because Rashad Vaughn has been a really good rebounder in conference play. And with him out, that's the thing UNLV misses on defense. So if Cornish can grab six defensive rebounds like he did against Air Force, that I think goes a long way to replacing Rashad Vaughn on the other end of the court. All right, the last one, UNLV forced just five turnovers against Air Force, and UNLV had just two fast break points.
I would say those are both indicative of things that we already know about UNLV. They don't force turnovers on defense, whether they're playing man-to-man or zone. It's just not something that they put an emphasis on. It's not something they try to do. I think part of that is because of the youth of the team, and part of that is just the defensive philosophy. They don't do a lot of trapping or pressure or doubling. They don't do it. They don't really actively seek out turnovers. They sort of just, you know, they play their defense and they challenge you to make shots over it. But I mean, you've got to do better than five.
Do you skill the players on this team? How many of them do you think would be really good in a high pressure defense and trying to get out in transition?
On defense, let me go down the roster. Let's start. Chris Wood, no, I don't think he would be a good fit for that style. I don't think he gets up and down the court quickly enough. Okonobo, I think, could fit with a little more experience. Morgan, yes. Kendrick, yes. Vaughn, I would say no. McCaw, yes. Cornish, I think if you coached him up, he could probably get it. Doolin, I would say no. Walker, I would say no.
I think Pat McCaw would be really good at
it. He's probably the prototype backcourt guy that you would want in like a trapping, pressing defense with his length and his quickness. He gets a ton of deflections as it is. He's really the only guy they have that can disrupt the offense just by, you know, playing defense and being long and quick and sort of getting in the passing lanes. He's really the only guy that does that.
And then he would have the ability after getting a steal to turn that into points, whether he's going to throw an alley-oop or shoot a three. He's going to usually get a high-quality look for somebody in the fast break. So I think he would be really good at it. I don't know that anybody else on this team would be really good at it right now. I think Dwayne Morgan kind of has the athletic ability to help get steals and then run up the floor and throw down a dunk, but I don't know that. I mean, he'd probably get called for a charge with how often he gets called for fouls. So, I don't know. I've said I think they would be better if they pressured more on defense and tried to get a couple more easy baskets. But when you look at the roster, I don't know how many guys that really fits very much for. But I do think Pat McCaw would just be unbelievable if that's what they decided to do. All right. Rashad Vaughn. Seen one game without him, or half a game, I guess, if you didn't go to it. You didn't really see the first half on ESPN3. But offensively, I don't think that the offensive sets that Dave Rice runs and sort of the philosophies they use, I don't think it's going to change very much. They still are running a lot of the baseline screening action that Rashad Vaughn was working off of, except now it's Pat McCaw, maybe a little bit of Jalon Kendrick. A lot of their same plays that Chris Wood gets on the inside are going to be there. So I don't think from a, you know, strategic standpoint or a this is what we're going to run offensively standpoint, it changes very much.
No, I think the offense that you saw against the Air Force is pretty much what you would have seen if Vaughn had been in there. I don't think that I think it's maybe too late in the season to see any vast, team-wide changes So I think what you see is probably what you're going to get, but just with more McCaw and more Cornish as the guys who are, you know, getting those touches and, you know, getting their number called.
I would, so I am a huge fan of stretch fours. Like, I love big guys that can shoot threes. And I love the horn set where you have your two big guys at the elbows and your point guard goes off a ball screen one way or the other. I would imagine something that could work really well for this offense is if you have Jordan Cornish as your four man and then either Wood or Okonobo as the five man, having a horn set with a ball screen for Pat McCaw that allows Wood to roll to the basket or cut to the basket and has Cornish pop out for three would be something that could work really well for UNLV. Now, you can only really run that against man. You're not going to get anything against zone, which UNLV sees a lot of, but I feel like that's something they could do offensively, maybe a little bit different with Rashad Vaughn out. But with Vaughn out, I don't think they're going to be able to score against San Diego State very well, or New Mexico, or even Wyoming's had a pretty decent defense. I don't think they're going to be able to score against those teams. Air Force, I think, is second or third to last in the conference in defensive efficiency. So I don't think there's a lot to take away from that game that, oh, they played well offensively. But when they play San Diego State, Wyoming back-to-back, when they get New Mexico here, I don't think they're going to score much against those teams.
So you're not optimistic then for their regular season chances of climbing up the standings?
No, not at all. I was going to ask you, we've both said, you know, 6 seed, they'll probably get 5 seed is a good possibility. Now with Rashad Vaughn out, now that they've lost to Air Force, I don't really think they have a shot at the 6 seed anymore.
No, I would say it's probably over. They're 2 games behind, Utah State, Fresno. They would have to jump, you know, Fresno or Utah and New Mexico. There's too many teams. They would have to win too many games the rest of the way. I think they're probably not going to get there. So
they're in 8th right now. You think they finish 8th?
I think they could. I mean, they just lost to April. I think they could stay ahead of the teams that they're ahead of right now.
Yeah, so they're a game ahead of Air Force, but Air Force still hasn't had either of their byes. So Air Force has played 2 more games. So UNLV is 5-7, Air Force is 5-9. That translates to a whole game ahead, but, you know, if UNLV drops the 2 games while Air Force is on a bye, they're technically tied. And then Nevada Reno is 1 game behind, having played the same amount as UNLV. I think they stay ahead of both of them. Who does UNLV beat, though? I'm not sure. I mean, they'll beat San Jose State to end the year, but
at Utah State next week?
I don't know that they go to Utah State and win now. I don't know though. Like they're not going to beat Boise State. They're not going to beat San Diego State. They could beat Wyoming if Larry Nance never comes back. But I think by the time UNLV plays them, Nance will probably be back. So there's 1 more game besides that, right? New Mexico.
Boise, New Mexico, Utah State, Wyoming, San Diego, San Jose.
I guess they could get New Mexico. They could get Utah State, but I don't know that they will. I look at this. I mean, San Jose State is as close to a given as you're going to get in any conference play, I guess. But other than that, none of these games stick out anymore as, okay, UNLV is going to – they'll win that one. That's kind of one they'll get pretty much regardless. But I don't see one anymore.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. San Jose State, I think they'll get Utah State. I think they can – at Utah State, I think they can get that one. It's not – I wouldn't bet on it. But
Are they gonna need David Collette to foul Cody Doolin at the other free throw line again?
I don't know. For some reason I'm still having trouble adjusting my expectations despite the injury. I think they can get that game. I would say 2 wins the rest of the way.
So to me now, I don't know, we're still framing this season as okay, win the conference tournament, get to the NCAA tournament. They've got to finish as the 8 or 9 seed if they want to do that, because if they fall to the 10 seed, that means in the first round they'll have to play New Mexico, Utah State, or Fresno State, which is not ideal when if you're the 8 or 9 seed, you get to play either Air Force or Nevada Reno. So to me, I think kind of the goal is to finish as the 8 seed, and kind of the minimum would be, okay, if we get the 9 seed, that's okay. That just kind of changes what color jersey we're wearing on the first day of the first game of the tournament.
Yeah. I think they can do that.
How far can they go in the tournament without Rashad Vaughn?
Without Rashad Vaughn? I just gave you the list of teams I think they can beat without Rashad Vaughn. It's Utah State, San Jose State. That's probably it.
Can they beat Nevada Reno without Rashad Vaughn?
They split with Rashad Vaughn, so I mean,
like
they can win that game, but I don't know if I would expect them to win that game.
So how far can they go if Rashad Vaughn comes back the day before the tournament and is like 60% or something? Like if he comes back and isn't in pain or whatever, he can play through whatever pain, but maybe he's just a little rusty.
Well, I guess what you would say, we saw Rashad Vaughn in preseason coming off of a knee injury that, you know, had him out for a while. And in the preseason, I mean, I thought that he was okay when we saw him in practice and when we saw him in the scrimmages. I mean, he was okay. He wasn't great. I mean, he was really hitting his stride right now. His last couple of games have been really good. So, I mean, if we get the Rashad Vaughn that we had the first, you know, 2 weeks of the season, I mean, it'll help. It'll still help. I don't know if it'll make them a contender to win the conference tournament, though.
Yeah, I don't think it does either.
I mean, he'll be able to knock down threes. I mean, he'll be able to do that if he comes back, which is not in any way guaranteed. Like, that's way up in the air. I think that's probably a coin toss at best.
So, more important question, does this injury make him more likely or less likely to go pro?
I don't know. I think there's a couple schools of thought on that. There's one school of thought where, hey, now let's try to come back next year and prove that. I've seen him mocked, you know, late first round for most of the season. So do you want to come back and prove that you can last an entire season? Because he's been injury prone the past 2 years. I mean, he's had multiple knee issues. So does he want to come back and prove that he is healthy and that, you know, he's worth, you know, taking spending a first round pick on? Or the other school of thought is that he's had multiple knee issues now in the past year plus, and with athletes, you know, there's no guarantees with injuries. He's a NBA talent, so the other option is for him to go now while he can and get a guaranteed contract, and, you know, not risk it playing another year in college and getting hurt again.
That's what I tend to agree with. As a college athlete, I would go pro. Like, I wouldn't, you know, if I've got this issue that, okay, I might, you know, do something that ends my basketball career, I'd say, no, thank you. I'll take early second round, late first round money or whatever it is. And, go try to prove myself in the NBA and at least get that first contract. That's my train of thought. And that is, people, in terms of the whole NBA college basketball one and done situation, you know, people complain that the way college is set up, it's not fair that guys can be that good at a sport and they could be making a lot of money in the NBA, but they have to go to college for a year. That argument, I always kind of hate it, because you don't have to go to college. You can go play overseas. You can go to the NBA D League. You can go make money playing basketball. It's just not the ideal situation of going straight to the NBA or whatever. But this is the one place where I feel sorry for the athletes, in that if you go to college, which is fine, you can do something in college that screws up your career, and you can't ever get that first contract. Which is so, I would go pro if I were him. Like, to me, if I was Rashad Vaughn, this would make me say, okay, I'm not wasting my time here anymore, where I'm not getting this mega contract that I could be getting from some NBA team.
I mean, that's pretty much my way of thinking also. Whenever people ask me, you know, about last year, it was, you know, Kem Birch and Roscoe Smith or whoever it is, or Anthony Bennett the year before that. I mean, the answer is always, you know, if you can get paid to play basketball and you want to be a basketball player, go do that. The sooner you can do that, the better, I'd say. I mean, the NBA will find you if you have to play in the D League, or if you're going to go overseas, even if you're not going to be a first round pick. If you want to play and get paid, there are options to do that. The NBA will find you if you're good enough. Get paid to do it, and no, you don't have that injury risk always hanging over you.
Yeah, it's like any other profession. If some company tried to hire you in a job you really wanted to do, you wouldn't say, oh, no, I need to go to college and get my degree in that first. Like, you wouldn't turn down the opportunity to do sort of a dream job, which is kind of, I don't know, we always assume basketball players, it's a dream to play in the NBA when, you know, we find out with guys like Larry Sanders and the Bucks, who was like, I don't like playing basketball, I just happen to be good at it. But assuming Rashad Vaughn, it's a dream to play in the NBA, like, if it's any other profession, if you know, you wanted to be a doctor and they said, no, you don't have to go to school, which would be terrible, but you wouldn't go to school, you'd just take the job. So, I don't know, it's... I wouldn't blame him, and I do think it means he's more likely to go pro. Chris Wood, last two games, he has scored 58 points, grabbed 28 rebounds, blocked 12 shots. He's shooting 54%, and he's been to the free throw line 25 times and knocked down 76% of them. Holy crap, Chris Wood's really good at basketball.
And speaking of the NBA, you know what every UNLV fan is thinking when they watch Chris Wood, the way that he is – just bounced back from – he's sort of got a very neat little narrative working this season where he came out strong, then he struggled as opponents sort of adapted to him and gave him a little more attention. And now he's it seems like he's got it all figured out right now. He's playing great. He's been unbelievable the last two games. And I would say that definitely makes him more likely to throw his name in there.
Yeah, if he keeps putting up like 27 points and 10 to 19 rebounds, yeah, I mean, he's going to rise up a couple more spots. He's all of a sudden like, oh, he might be a lottery pick. Yeah, he'll be gone. The one negative to his last two games is that he's only 1 of 5 on threes.
I guess the progress there would be that he's only taken 5 in two games.
Yeah, and well, here's the thing. With Chris Wood and his three-point shooting, Chris Wood shooting threes is not good for UNLV basketball.
No.
But Chris Wood shooting threes is what he needs to do for his NBA prospects. Like, to me, if I'm looking at it of, okay, UNLV needs to win a game, UNLV needs to be better, I would say Chris Wood doesn't ever need to shoot a three. But if I'm looking at it from Chris Wood as an individual and he wants to play in the NBA, I would say Chris Wood needs to shoot threes. Like, he needs to show I can knock this shot down, because as a skinny forward, that makes him much more valuable for the NBA.
Yeah, it was a similar situation a couple years ago for UNLV when they had Mike Moser, who was he had been a really good power forward the year before. They brought in Anthony Bennett as a freshman who was obviously going to play and be the starting power forward. So Moser, who was going to be a small forward, a swing forward in the NBA anyways, sort of tried to play that position for UNLV. He had to shoot more outside. It wasn't good for UNLV, but he sort of had to prove that he could hit three-pointers and he could handle the ball and he could play on the perimeter. So, I mean, we've seen that at UNLV pretty recently. Similar situation with Wood, I guess. I mean, I don't know how much he's proving to the NBA by making, you know, 20-something percent of them. It might be better to not give them that sample of him shooting three-pointers.
Leave it a mystery. Say, yeah, I can shoot him, I just don't.
Yeah, show up at the combine and, you know, make 5 out of 10, you know, standing still against no defense, and then let them draw their own conclusions. But no, it's you can sort of sense that from the fan base how great it would be if Wood did return next year. I don't think it's going to happen, but how the huge building block that he would be if he were to play next year and give you performances like this on a consistent basis from the beginning of the season to the end of the season.
Here's what I've seen from Chris with the last two games. He's against Fresno State. He got out and ran on the break really well. Air Force, not as much. UNLV didn't have fast break opportunities, although he did score their only two fast break points when Jalon Kendrick threw it off the backboard to him, which kind of took me by surprise that Jalon did that, because there was a defender there. I just wasn't expecting him to go off the backboard there. But he's ran well in transition against Fresno State. Against Fresno State, they played man-to-man the whole game against UNLV, and Chris Wood was awesome against it, because what UNLV, their offense has sort of morphed into this, and I don't know how much it'll change with Rashad Vaughn out, but they run a guard off of baseline screens. We saw it a little bit earlier, but now that's like become the thing they do against man offense. or man defense, is they'll run a guard off baseline screens of Wood and Okanobo or whatever forwards are in. And what they do with Chris Wood, when the guard comes off of his screen to run to the opposite side, Wood just turns and posts his man. And all of a sudden, Chris Wood has a post up from 10, 12 feet away. Typically, he turns and faces up and drives. That's what he did a lot against Fresno State. And it worked really well. Didn't do it. It wasn't that much against Air Force because they were in man-to-man, or they were in zone more than they were in man-to-man, but they were still able to get Chris Wood the ball against the zone defense because he did a pretty good job of cutting into the openings and then scoring from wherever he caught it. So he's, to me, when so here's the thing. After the Fresno State game, I was like, Chris Wood's better against man-to-man. He is not good against zone defenses. I went and looked at the synergy stats for it. He's actually a lot more efficient against zone defenses than he is man defenses. But what I think I've determined from that is that's because he doesn't get the ball as much against zone defenses. And when he does, it's because he's made a good cut into an opening and he catches wide open. Mm-hmm. Whereas against man, they just dump him the ball like whenever they can, and he's just got to go make something happen. Mm-hmm.
And he's still not – I would say that he's still not a great – you know, post up, low post player. I mean, just from watching him this year, I mean, he's scoring a lot because he's tall and he's long and he can get his shot off and he's got a really nice touch around the basket for a big man. I would say that he still really hasn't reached his potential in terms of like his footwork and actually his post moves, like a lot of his drop steps, you know, kind of, it's not like a quick hitting move. It's more of like a slow, he's beating you just with his length and the long steps that he can take. And then he's too tall for a lot of the college players to challenge his shot. So I would say that he's not even really that developed as a post scorer against man defenses, but just the talent is so immense that he's still able to put up the numbers that he's been putting up the last few games.
We've talked about it before. Like when he has his back to the basket and then decides he's going to shoot, he does that really weird thing where he jumps up and then twists his body and throws it at the rim.
Which is just pure athletic ability. Just being able to jump and turn your body in midair. You know, most players, when you post up, you're taught to, you know, get your off shoulder in between the defender and the ball and sort of use your leverage and get him off balance and then use your body to shield the ball. He doesn't do any of that, really. He just sort of gets as close to the basket as he can. Then he rises up and he turns around and he just shoots over the top of people.
Yeah, and the weird thing is, like, the practices that I've been to, they work on, like, they do one-on-one post-up drills. And it's like somebody works with Dwayne Morgan, somebody works with Chris Wood, somebody works with Goodluck. And they're, like, saying, okay, you're going to do a drop step, spin and dunk it, or whatever move they want him to go through. And, like, Chris Wood does those, and he looks like a fluid post-up thing. But then we don't ever see it in the game. We just see him, okay, I'm kind of at the block. I'm going to jump now and shoot.
But the thing is... I want to say it was the New Mexico game, maybe, where it was one of the first possessions of the game where he caught a ball posting up, like an extended post up on the baseline. He's probably, you know, 10, 12 feet from the basket at least. And he just made up his mind before he caught the ball that he was going to spin baseline. So he caught the ball, spun baseline, and it was not a quick spin. It was not I didn't even expect him to win. I didn't even expect him to get the edge. But he just did his slow spin, and he took one step, and he dunked it with two hands because his steps are so long. That he was just able to corner around the defender just by taking the length of his steps, and then he just dunked from there, which is an amazing play.
Can Chris Wood take over a game and upset somebody in the Mountain West tournament?
Can he be Danny Manning and just throw a team on his back for three games against? I don't see it happening against, you know, San Diego State defense or, you know, Wyoming or these other teams that they're going to have to beat in a row to win the conference tournament. But I could definitely see him winning a game. I mean, he's – what more can he really do? I mean, defensively, I mean, I guess he could be a little bit stronger, but, I mean, he's blocking shots. He's scoring super efficiently. I mean, if they were to get a favorable matchup against a team that couldn't defend him down low, would the coaches just feed him down there and let him get up, you know, 25 shot attempts the way that we've seen Vaughn, you know, go up around 20 attempts sometimes? Maybe we could see that.
UNLV needs to get the 7 seed because San Diego State's going to get the 1 seed. They need to avoid San Diego State until the final round if they were able to get that far. They need to get the 7 because then they'll get, like, Boise or something. Boise's not as good defensively, and Chris Wood could take over offensively against Boise. Now, could UNLV stop Derek Marks enough? That's another story. But they need to get the 7 so they can avoid San Diego State. That's kind of how – that needs to be their goal. Get the 7 seed. That way you don't have to play San Diego State until the final if you were able to do that. But, yeah, I don't think he can win 3 straight, 4 straight, but I think he could win one. You know, they could get, you know, Air Force or Nevada or somebody in the first round, beat them by just whatever, being a little bit better, and then maybe you get Boise or Colorado State and Chris Wood goes off and now you're all of a sudden upset somebody and you've got hope because you're in the semis. I don't know. I think there's a little bit of hope for Chris Wood to do that because he's been phenomenal the last two games. UNLV plays Boise State this week. Are they going to be able to stop Derek Jones? Derek Marks, I mean?
No, probably not. They couldn't stop him at full strength. I don't think so. I mean, he's going to put up his numbers. I think it's probably going to be a case of how efficient can they be defensively against, you know, the rest of the Boise State players, you know, the type of offense they're going to run. They're going to do their handoffs. They're going to do their big men. It's going to be Duncan shooting threes and the other guys popping out and, you know, cutting to the basket. How well can they stop the rest of that as opposed to just trying to put the clamps on Derek Marks, which they're not going to be able to do anyways.
Marks is taking 36% of Boise State shots, which is like, he's like top 10 in the country in terms of the percentage of shots he takes of his team. But he's still in the top 100 in the entire country in effective field goal percentage. Like, he is taking a ton of shots, and he's still scoring efficiently. Like, it's incredible. He is, like,
see the player.
He's about,
see the player.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Year. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, with Nance missing 2 or 3 games, whatever, or however many he's going to end up missing, it's not, I don't think it's close anymore. Like, Derek Marks, it's over. Like, he's incredible. Like, it's, normally when you shoot more than a third of your team's shots, you don't do it that efficiently. Like, Rashad Vaughn wasn't taking as many shots of his teams as Derek Marks is. And Rashad Vaughn, while he was shooting well in conference play, was okay from an efficiency standpoint. Derek Marks is like, he's one of the best in the country in terms of efficiency, and he's taking it's unbelievable how good he's been for Boise this year.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know if the UNLV has a, who's the guy, if you're going to, first, do you think that they would play man-to-man against Marks? Secondly, do they have a guy that could defend him? I mean, I guess McCaw is probably the first option that you would choose.
Yeah, I would think it would be McCaw. I might lean towards Kendrick, though. Just because Kendrick's a little bit bigger and that might give Marks a little bit more of an issue. What did they play against Boise the first meeting?
I think they historically against Boise, I think they mostly play man to man and they switch all the handoffs on the perimeter.
Yeah.
That's right.
They switched 1 through 5 against Boise, didn't they?
I think they go over like ball screens, and then they switch off handoffs or something like that.
Yeah, I would. You know what I would love to see, but I don't think he can do it. Would be putting Chris Wood on Derek Marks for a couple possessions just to see if a 6'9", 6'10" guy bothers him. But I don't think he can stay with him well enough.
Just the. So you want to see them throw a couple possessions, just junk defenses, yeah. Just see what it. See, I mean, what do you have to lose at this point?
Yeah, like, if Dwayne Morgan could play without fouling, put Dwayne Morgan on him for 5 or 6 possessions and see what happens. And just see if that length bothers him. Because, and I don't know how other teams have defended him all year, but I don't think anybody else has put, like, a 6'8 guy, 6'9 guy on him and said, okay, now what are you going to do?
I agree with the theory. I can see it. I'm not sure that Dwayne Morgan in particular would give Marks much of a problem. I think we would see Dwayne Morgan back heading toward the bench with 3 fouls pretty quickly. Marks is a pretty polished offensive guy. I think he would know what he's doing against. But like Wood or Kendrick, a guy with length, maybe the way to go. Someone who could, you know, maybe back off him a step or two and still maybe be able to challenge a shot a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know. I would like to see it for a couple possessions just to – because, I mean – Pat McCaw is your best defender. Jalon Kendrick's been good this year, too. Like, I don't think either one of them is going to bother him that much, though. Like, yeah, Pat McCaw might steal his dribble once or twice, but otherwise, I don't think he's going to really disrupt his shot, disrupt his rhythm too much, and I don't know. I just don't feel there's a whole lot that UNLV can do from just, okay, we're going to put Makar, Kendrick on him. Maybe they should run a box and one.
You could blitz him a little bit. I mean, you could send a second guy at him, but they haven't done that all year with anyone. So
yeah.
We haven't seen that at all.
I would like to see him. I would really like to see him blitz off the ball screen, though. And they haven't done that either. But if they send a big guy out and you've got Chris Wood and McCall, send them both at marks and at least make him give it up. Yeah, Nick Duncan might hit three threes in a row like he did against San Diego State last week or 2 weeks ago, but I don't know. I don't know. I think Derek Marks is too good to just, hey, this is what we're going to play defensively. And I don't know. You might be able to beat him if you say, okay, Derek Marks, you can have yours, but nobody else's. I don't know. Maybe that's a better strategy. Let Marks get his. He'll go for 40, but everybody else is going to score 20 or something combined, and we're going to win this game 65-60.
I think that's probably the tack that we'll see them take. I think they're just going to play their straight-up defense and take their chances.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to see something creative. Even if they get burned, I'd rather see something creative and weird than straight up. Oh, well. Okay. Last thing, Jerry Tarkanian. I just moved to Los Angeles. I haven't even been here a year. Just started covering UNLV, so I never talked to Jerry Tarkanian. Didn't know a ton about him when I moved here. Read a lot about him. I think the best thing I read was from Dan Wetzel, who had just a really long, great story. It had two, he had listed out three quotes from him. Two of them were awesome. The one, the NCAA is so mad at Kentucky, it's going to give Cleveland State two more years probation. And then I always like to get transfers, especially from the Pac-10. They already have their cars paid for. I don't know. I don't usually, like to read a ton about whatever non-sporting event that happened in the sports world. But I read quite a bit of stuff that people wrote about Tarkanian and enjoyed most of it. And mainly it was, I don't know very much about Tarkanian. I'm going to learn about it. So I don't know.
No, it's a similar situation. I haven't been here for 3 years. All I knew about Tark and UNLV before I got here was, the stuff that he's famous for, the towel and the 1990 championship team and, the Larry Johnson, Stacey Ogman teams. But I never got a chance to meet him or talk to him. But one of the things that I noticed early on was how ingrained in the community he is, just around UNLV basketball. He hasn't coached here since 92, so 20 years since I got here. He hadn't coached in UNLV in 20 years, and he's still . You would almost think that he's still the coach of the team, the way people talk about it. They talk about those teams, the 90 championship team, like it was last year. The people still clamor for, they want the Rebels to play that style of basketball. They want that team. They want to play that style. They want to play that defense. They want to play that offense. They want to recruit those type of players. They want their coach to be a character like Tarkanian. They want him with the quips and the one-liners. And as you and I well know, Dave Rice is the complete opposite of that.
Yes, exactly.
But Tark is the complete and total blueprint for everything they want UNLV basketball to be, including the bad stuff. I think that people take pride in the fact that that he was a Rebel and that he was shady in some of his recruiting. And I think people take pride in that. And I think that's also part of it. And that's part of the reason why he's so loved around these parts.
How many coaches in all college sports have been forced to resign? I think that's what happened. I don't remember exactly, but I think the proper terminology was he was forced to resign as head coach, but it's still Tarkanian court and there's still a statue. How many coaches have a statue at the school they were forced to resign from?
I don't know. It's a crazy situation. And it's obviously people took his side when it came down to, the university administration versus Tarkanian. So, I mean, I guess he won in the end in the court of public opinion. Everything is named after him, and he's still, the brand. He's still the UNLV brand.
I went back because the 1990 national title game against Duke is on YouTube, the whole thing, commercial free. It's an hour and 20 minutes or something. I watched it because I had never seen it before. It was so much. I understand why people would want that every game because it was awesome the way they played.
Yeah, it was a little before my time, so I don't remember that team playing. But I mean, you see some of the clips, or you see some of the scores, or just some of the numbers, and it's like every possession is a fast break, and even when they're playing defense, it's exciting because, you know, they're always, you know, pressuring, you know, the length of the court, or they're, you know, trapping, or they're trying to make things happen. So it's like you don't see opposing teams, you know, the first 10 seconds of the shot clock, you didn't see the opponents just, you know, pounding the ball, running their offense, you know, waiting for something to happen. It's like something was always happening on the court when they were playing.
Yeah, and it was incredible to watch the game against Duke. Duke couldn't set up anything. Like, their point guard would have to dribble back towards half court just to, like, get away and say, okay, holy hell, we need to set something up, but I can't do it around the three-point line. It was, I don't know, it was great. And that's the only game that I've really watched and paid attention to that Jerry Tarkanian has ever coached. But Dave Rice runs more sets per game than Tarkanian ran against Duke in that national title game.
Yeah.
Like, just wanted to get that out there because they ran about two, maybe three different offensive sets in that game. And one was a play for Anderson Hunt to catch and shoot. And then the other ones were just, they weren't even really great design. They were just kind of like, all right, we're going to get you into this position and then throw it into the post. Or we're going to hopefully create a lane right here and let Greg Anthony drive towards the paint. Like, that was it. They didn't really run offensive plays in that game other than two. So Dave Rice runs a lot more offensive plays than Jerry Tarkanian. But when you can get a steal and you can score like 40 fast break points in a game, that's much better offense.
How many did UNLV have against Air Force? It wasn't 40.
It wasn't 40. It was about 38 less.
Yeah. So I read your story on that, which I thought was great. But it's, you can see why the people around here still cling to those teams and they still want that style of basketball.
They gave UNLV's players on the bench the shirts that, like, were number one before the game was over, which I thought was great. But I also feel like if that happened now,
well,
everybody jumped down
there. Let me stop you right there. There's a lot of stuff reading about Tarkanian that you could start with if that happened now.
That's true.
So, like, there was a completely different era, and just, like, everything about it was, like, had some so many crazy stories to read about, and, like, everything had that sort of tinge where if it happened now, it would be unbelievable, and it would be the biggest, like, scandal or the biggest news story. I don't think Jerry Tarkanian was built for, like, the 24-hour SportsCenter news cycle.
Jerry Tarkanian was not built for Twitter.
No.
In that story, I took a screenshot and put it in there. A guy in the stands had a hat on that had, like, the face of a shark coming out of it with its teeth. UNLV needs to make those and give those away. Like, those are the coolest hats ever. Those would be way cooler than the Santa hats they gave away before during the era.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I mean, I would wear it. I would go take one out of the seats and wear it during the game if they did. Yeah. Like, those are tremendous. But
yeah. People buy the Hunt, Anthony, Johnson, Augman jackets. Like, I've seen multiple of those. So people, like, still, you know, they still love that team, and they still love Tarkanian.
Yeah, so Jerry Tarkanian, okay. Yeah, like, got to be the most beloved. And they're doing the whole dim the lights for Tarkanian. I saw you tweet, if you don't dim the lights for Tarkanian, who are you going to do it for?
I mean, in Las Vegas, like, I admit, like, I'm not a Las Vegas insider. It's only been a few years, but I read that they did it for Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis, but I mean, if you don't do it for Tarkanian, who else, like, if someone else died tomorrow, who from that list would they do it for? I can't think of it. Like, Oscar Goodman, maybe, who was the mayor for a long time and is sort of a Vegas character. But, like, maybe it's just my ignorance from not being a Vegas native, but I can't really think of many other people that you would do it for.
Yeah. Are all the casinos on board? The last I saw, everybody was, except there was like one, maybe two casinos that hadn't said anything about it.
The last I saw was the Wynn was not on board. But then I read on Twitter that some people were saying that Steve Wynn, like, had some kind of feud with Jerry Tarkanian, or he had some kind of some kind of rivalry with Tarkanian on a personal level. But, like, of course, I have no idea if any of this is true. So, I mean, don't quote me on this, but that's what I saw on Twitter, so I don't know what's going on there. But I think it was, like, every casino except the Wynn, even some of the downtown and, like, the native casinos and stuff. So it's going to happen, obviously.
Yeah. All right, well, that will do it for this edition of the Towel Boys. I'm Tyler Bischoff over at Mountain West Connect. He's Mike Grimala over at RunRevs.com. That's Mike's new dog making an appearance here late in the show. Where's he riding at? Does he have a website?
He does not have a website right now. He's just barking at the door. You can...
So, okay. Thank you guys for tuning in. Until next week, this has been the Talent Voice.